Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
A couple of weeks ago, the first poll came out that shows us up more than 2 points over the junior senator from the state of Texas. The 6th of November, that's the day where we decide our future, our fortune, our fate, not just as Texans, but as Americans, not just for this generation, but every generation that follows.
El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke rode a blue wave across Texas into the November 2018 elections. He was challenging incumbent Senator Ted Cruz. O'Rourke ultimately lost by the narrowest of margins. It was a progressive movement filmmaker Kevin Ford wanted to capture on film. What it became was the profile of two women of color in Texas who were recently elected into office. The film also shines a light on immigrant rights and institutional racism in Texas. Ford joins us on Fronteras to tell us how the project shifted focus during the filmmaking process.
When we set out to make the film, one of the things that kind of rooted us in a time and place was the midterm elections. And we hit the road, and I was kind of documenting some of that. And I was, at the time, hoping to kind of look at things happening around the state that were indicating some type of shift in Texas. And as the race went on, one thing that surprised me, and it became almost a gravitational pull, the way that the Trump administration kept focusing on the border. So even though I was setting out originally to kind of look at a wide cross-section of the state, another thing would happen at the border, or he would send the military to the border, or, you know, there was this whole thing about the migrant caravan. And so I kept kind of being pulled back, and I feel like the film really shows that struggle of, like, you kind of set out, you're going to look at this kind of bigger story, but then reality happens, and it just kept pulling me back down to the border. And at the same time, I started to realize that what was happening at the border also tied in with some of the other struggles that we were capturing around the state of people just dealing with racism. And the two really became kind of an A and B storyline that complemented each other, because really the current situation at the border also had roots in this history of racial oppression throughout the state. It really was kind of a, you're heading out to do one thing and then you get a little bit sideswiped. And as a documentarian, you just kind of go with that. And I couldn't have predicted how much the border was going to continue to be an issue during and then especially after the election.
Well, I noticed that there's a particular focus on El Paso in this particular film. It starts in El Paso with Veronica Escobar, who's campaigning for Congress at the time when the film begins.
I am a third-generation El Pasoan. My family has been in this community on what I call the magical U.S.-Mexico border for over 100 years.
And the film ends with Veronica Escobar in Congress, and she is giving the response to the most recent State of the Union in Spanish.
Recuerdo haber visto la Estatua de Libertad en Ellis Island por primera vez. Estaba asombrada de Lady Liberty. Ella se erige como la guardiana de nuestros ideales, que todas las personas son criadas iguales, que los vulnerables deben ser atendidos y no rechazados, y que los Estados Unidos es el brillante ejemplo de bondad.
Why did you choose to use sort of her ascendancy to frame your film?
The storyline with Veronica, in the end of the day, after we had filmed for well over a year and a half, you know, we're sitting in the edit room and we've got all kinds of assemblies of the film and lots of characters. And when our team really talked about it, we kind of all realized there was one voice that really tied everything together the most and symbolized this pushback that we're attempting to show, and that was Congresswoman Escobar. So we didn't set out to tell her story, but by, again, similar to how I just described, by the events that kept unfolding and happening, she kept emerging more and more as a voice and was put in a position where she continually had to deal with what was happening in her community, especially after the shooting that happened in El Paso and her stepping up and being a voice in that period. It just kind of was like, wow, we never set out as that was going to be a part of our story. But in the end of the day, looking back, it was just so obvious.
Everywhere I go now, people are telling me, be careful, be careful, be safe, be safe. We never used to have to say that to one another. And I feel like that was taken from us, and we were so proud of it. Language and words made us unsafe.
And so she just became a really clear start to finish for us to focus on, but still allowing us also to find other stories that reinforced the journey that she was on.
Before we get to the characters who are featured in this particular documentary, you want to talk a little bit more about El Paso. And I'm sure as you were making this film, you found that El Paso was sort of more the center of these immigration policies. It was really a guinea pig for Trump administration policies. You had child detention, separation at the border, the Tornillo Detention Center, migrants who were detained under overpasses, the militarization of the border, nothing like the El Paso Juarez region or any other region along the Texas-Mexico border has seen. Did you find that El Paso almost sort of had to have much of your focus because of what was happening on the border, because of its role as a testing ground for these policies?
I did find that. And keep in mind, I am no expert. I'm just a documentary filmmaker. And so I was learning about all of this in real time and just kind of being led by unfolding events. So a lot of the things that made it really difficult to just get this movie down into 90 minutes was you could have gone and done hours just on each city or each segment. Yet we wanted to just kind of get into the broad, bigger picture of it all. And so some of the specific policies that you mentioned were very eye-opening to me, and we did get loads of interviews and things, and I learned a lot about that in the process. But I still overall just tried to kind of lay out an impression of just what was happening in the region without specifically getting too much into one particular policy. And that was only for time, because our film probably would have been 4 hours at that point. And that's where it started. Our first assembly cut was like 4 hours long, and we thought, okay, we've got to start to not go so into the weeds, but at the same time, just show the higher level view of it all, of everything that you just mentioned.
And unfortunately, all this negative attention on El Paso ended up literally turning it into a target. And
right.
You were there right in the aftermath of the shootings that happened in August. Could you talk a little bit about your experience?
And that was a case. Before that happened, I thought, you know, we're in the home stretch. We're kind of wrapping up our story. And I was actually back home in, I live in California. I lived in Texas for 10 years. I was home there. This happened and I saw it on the news like everybody else and was just completely devastated, especially because I had spent so much time down in El Paso. It just stunned me. My co-producer and editor and camera operator in the film, Zach Passero, lives in El Paso. And I called him that day and I just, you know, he was obviously devastated. He's here in the community in real time. And I just said, I don't even know what you're going through right now. I mean, but if you find it in you to get down there with a camera to one of the memorials, Veronica was speaking, Beto was speaking, and several people were getting together and having a vigil. And so Zach said, I'm already there. You know, he didn't even miss a beat. He goes, I knew we would have to get it. Of course, I'm on my way. And that was part of his process of dealing with it himself, just as a resident in the community, was to get out there with a camera and kind of witness. And my wife, who's a producer on the film, we were sitting there in Los Angeles, and she said, you got to go. You cannot just sit here and let Zach deal with this on his own. So I got basically immediately on a flight down and joined up with Zach and some of our other collaborators down here. And it made it so much more real. When you live outside of, in this case, when you live in California and this is happening in Texas, you see it on the news, but it wasn't until I got here and just stood at the site and really looked at the memorial, looked at the photos of people, read the names, it just really hit home in a whole different way that human lives had been erased and had been inspired by such hate. Coming from our heart, we tried to document it and just witness it, and that became a huge part of the film. But if you had asked me 6 months before that, I could have predicted that something horrible like that would have happened. Although with the Trump administration and the rhetoric and the policies, now looking back, it does seem it was inevitable that some kind of incident like this would occur. There was just too much hatred being stoked.
Kevin Ford is director and producer of The Pushback. When we come back...
What emerged was a film that was about people standing up to bigotry. So therefore, you could be at the border, or you could be in the heart of Austin, Texas, or some of the folks up in Dallas, or as far away as a place like Nacogdoches. Everywhere I started to realize, okay, maybe there's a pattern here of just, you know, battling bigotry.
More with filmmaker Kevin Ford is next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The documentary The Pushback follows a group of Texans, some progressive and some not, who stand up to bigotry. Two main characters featured prominently are women of color who are new to elected office, El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar and Austin City Councilwoman Natasha Harper Madison. Harper Madison started her campaign on a wing and a prayer.
Would you mind if I give you a little bit of literature? You haven't voted so far.
I voted already.
You don't have to keep that paper unless, of course, you just want to look at my pretty face. But my name is Natasha Harper Madison, and I'm running for Austin City Council.
She was elected, but a bitter debate on homelessness in Austin led Harper Madison to become the target of attacks.
There used to be little placards over our spots that say, you know, whose spot it is. And, you know, once I started getting some threats, I realized I was just starting to recognize where the gaps were. And talking to my colleagues, and we all sort of agreed it was not safe to designate whose car is where.
Kevin Ford is the producer and director of The Pushback. He says Harper Madison's story unveiled yet another layer of bigotry and discrimination as he was making the film.
What I thought was interesting right off the bat when I met Natasha was right off the bat, she made it clear that she was running for city council so that people like her, and that's in her words, would have some representation. And she wanted her daughters to see that people that looked like them would be represented in their city council. And it was really eye-opening because I told you I lived in Texas for 10 years. I lived in Austin, Texas. And in a lot of ways, Austin does get kind of painted with a broad brush of like, oh, it's like a liberal haven and the blue dot in the sea of red and stuff like that. And so here was this woman who was born and raised in Austin, and she had a lot to say about the history of racial segregation there. And that was part of why she was running. And she had a lot to say, and I had a lot of interest listening to her story. I remember one time I was filming with her in East Austin, and she said, let me ask you a question. Have you ever been here? And I was stunned because I had to say, honestly, no, I was always told to stay away from this part of town. And she's like, exactly. And she goes,
it was almost the opposite with her, right? Because she was saying her mother had never, ever stepped foot into City Hall.
Exactly. There, and that was her whole point, was that whatever the perception of the city is now or the branding of it, there's still a very deep racial divide there that exists.
The city of Austin in 1928 had what they called the 1928 Master Plan. And the Master Plan essentially dictated that if you were African American, which at the time they didn't call us that, you had to live in one specific part of town.
And anyway, so it was very eye-opening. And again, when I'm looking at this kind of overall pattern, what emerged was a film that was about people standing up to bigotry. So therefore, you could be at the border, or you could be in the heart of Austin, Texas, or some of the folks up in Dallas, or as far away as a place like Nacogdoches. Everywhere I started to realize, okay, maybe there's a pattern here of just, you know, battling bigotry.
The other folks who you interview in this particular film, you know, they range from a rancher, a disabled elderly rancher on the Rio Grande Valley, whose land is going to be divided by the wall. You speak to indigenous people who are also living in the valley, whose lands are being destroyed yet again. You talk to somebody from the National Butterfly Center, again, another area that would be split by a border wall. You speak to a former Border Patrol employee. You also speak to volunteers who are crossing into Matamoros to help out migrants. You talk to faith workers. You focus on the La Lomita Chapel in the Rio Grande Valley, which would end up on the Mexican side of the wall if that portion of the wall does go up.
For Fred here and his sister, I mean, this is their livelihood. And if they take that away from them, you know, that's a lot.
We have an inherent right to stand up for the land that our ancestors lived on. You're walking on our ancestors right now, you know?
So this is where the border wall is going to go. And 70% of our property is back here. It's going to be behind the border wall.
But those who believe and work from ignorance and brute force say, well, yea, though I walk through the valley of death, I will fear no evil, because I'm the richest and the toughest and the most powerful and the most cruel son of a bitch in the whole valley. It's almost like a fanatical loyalty to the powers that be. That certainly doesn't come from Christ and the apostles.
What I kind of loved about this film was that you let those voices carry your film along. You did not insert yourself into the film. There was no voiceover. There was no narration. The film was carried by the voices of your subjects.
Well, I really honestly appreciate you pointing that out, because that was 100% my intention. And the more that I could strip myself out of it and just let the people that I had the great fortune of coming into contact with, let their voices be heard. But I didn't have a set point of view going into this, or an agenda, or I knew what I was trying to tell you. I just wanted to be open and listen. And anyway, that's just something that gets into documentary style. Different documentarians deal with things differently, and some people really want to tell you exactly how you should feel. And I've always worked against that, especially in this film, just wanting to allow you space as a viewer to form your own feelings and opinions. But really, I wanted to focus on these progressive voices battling bigotry. And so I guess that's where my voice comes in, is like giving you this kind of sample group that I'm coming across. But it is something that actually personally I really appreciate. And I actually drew a lot of inspiration from my producer, Richard Linklater. In that sense, I always felt his movies show Texans in a really interesting light. And so even though this is a documentary, I would often think about Linklater and his work in the best way, how the characters' conversations carry the stories or communicate a bigger thing. And that was like something I really wanted to honor. And I thought it was really cool that he was kind of giving guidance and feedback along the way. And I think that influence really shows.
Well, it was a pretty big coup for you to get Richard Linklater on board. And, you know, you've had at least over 2 years worth of footage, starting with the Cruz O'Rourke race, going all the way to the end of the most recent State of the Union. You had some pretty late edits. So you had a lot of tape to work with. So I'm curious what the process was of breaking it down. How did Linklater and your other producers, how did they all come together to help you put this finished product out?
Again, I'll go back to my great friend and collaborator, Zach Passero, here in El Paso. At one point, we were hundreds of hours in, and one of the producers, James Stern, and he had said, you know, man, just get to work on your outline. Show me this film in a three-act structure as a challenge. Just type it. And it really helped. I was actually here on a shoot at that time in El Paso, and I went down to the plaza area, got a bunch of coffee, and I just sat there on my laptop and started jamming. And lo and behold, we ended up with a pretty solid outline. I was able to give that to my collaborator, Zach, But he started to just pull out those scenes, and by August 2019, we had a four-hour assembly. And at that point, what's great is everybody starts chiming in, talking about moments that hit them, characters that they identify with. The big challenge then came as new things would develop, such as what happened here in El Paso at Walmart. You know, that wasn't a part of my original outline because it hadn't happened. Hopefully I've shown enough of the stories in the film that at least will pique people's interest to care, because it's so hard to even care about politics right now. People just feel inundated and their lives are hard and people just want to turn off the news. I thought maybe if there was something that would evoke a feeling of democracy, of patriotism and participation, in the end of the day, hopefully people go and vote and let their feelings really be known.
Kevin Ford is the producer and director of The Pushback. Find out more about the documentary at thepushbackfilm.com. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Ben Henry is our podcast producer. And Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Special thanks this week to Dee Wu at member station KTEP in El Paso and Charles Horak. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.